This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast with Mark Stephen and Rachel Stewart from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. As you probably know, we built the Scotland Outdoors podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors.
And this week we've been finding out about a curious wee mammal, the water vole, that aren't.
Good morning. I'm Mark Stephen, right beside me here at Beech Grove in Aberdeen, looking quizzically. Rachel Stewart.
Apparently the puffins have returned to the Isle of May.
Oh, excellent.
The ospreys are beginning to come back as well.
Okay.
There's lovely little lambs in the field. It's very spring-like.
Very spring-like.
Very spring-like. And actually, yeah. there's been a few days of sunshine, I would say, over the last few days. But it is quite chilly still. You know, we've still got our big, thick, heavy coats
on.
Cold wind going down the back of your neck. I went for a wee walk last night and I thought, cold. Still
anything
cold.
To get out of the house.
Anything at all. Let us know what your plans are for today if you're going to be in the great outdoors. You can email us outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or you can text us 80295 or you can give Sky a ring on 0808 529500. You're looking up.
I'm just listening to the birds. Nice.
Very nice. Very nice. Light, the moment you've all been waiting for, our mystery sound this week.
Have I?
That's it.
Was that it?
That's it.
We're paying by the inch now it is. What's going on?
I know. You can email us then, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk, text 80295 or give us a ring on 0808 529500. We'll play it again soon.
We have commented on numerous occasions on this programme about bird of prey persecution and muir burn and lots of things that go on in the countryside. So you may have noticed this week that the Wildlife Management and Muir Burn Scotland Bill passed its final vote in Holyrood. Now, we'll hear more later on the impact the bill might have from the RSPB and Scottish Lands and Estates.
Yeah. We're also, as you know, all being encouraged to consider active travel these days. And this drew my attention quite recently when I visited the A1. In East Lothian, campaigners say their efforts are hampered by, of course, this very busy road, because for an 8-mile stretch, there's no official crossing linking the villages close to Dunbar with the coast. And it means, well, basically, you either have to drive there or risk crossing one of the busiest roads in the country. I met up with Chris Bruce from the East Lammermuir Community Council to see the problem for myself.
We're at the Dryburn crossing, which isn't a crossing, but it's a place where the path from a nearby village, Innerwick, used to go down to the coast, and there are people in the village who can remember herding cattle up and down that route, and it was a traditional route to access the beach and the coast from the village. But in between times, the so-called Dunbar Bypass, which isn't called that anymore, it's the A1, was built across the road, and so there's now a 8-mile section of A1 with no safe crossing point for people in the villages to get to and from the coast.
You're a keen cyclist. You're here on your bike today. What's it like to cross that road?
Well, it's not good if you're in a hurry. If you're patient and wait for a big gap in the traffic, you can get to the middle, then climb over the barrier, then cross again onto the other side.
I think we can safely get to the middle.
We need to jink up to the left a wee bit.
There is a central barrier here, so is there a gap in this barrier?
No gap.
So you have to lift your bike over the barrier.
The dual section here comes down to one carriageway, so sometimes you get people racing to overtake at the last minute. I hope they give you good insurance cover, Rachel. Right, let's go.
So we've made it across. It's certainly not the safest route, is it? I mean, I wouldn't be particularly happy with my children crossing the A1.
No, that people have been killed crossing there in the last 5 years, early in the morning.
Is there an alternative? How can you get around this?
Drive, sadly. There's another crossing outside Torness, which also involves taking your life in your hands across a dual section and a single carriageway section. A bit clearer than this, but still pretty much equally dangerous, I'd say.
So that's your option. You either jump in the car, or if you want to walk or take the bike, you have to cross the A1, and that's really the only way you're going to get to the beach.
Yeah. If you want to be active.
How do you feel about that, then?
In terms of, you know, obesity, diabetes, exercise, access to the countryside, we've designed a city. Well, we've accidentally come up with a set of circumstances that put people off all doing all the right things. But I think there's opportunities to do something about it coming up.
It's not the first time that this has been discussed. You know, there have been obviously calls here for a crossing before, but what's a bit different here is how it might be paid for. So explain your thinking behind that.
Well, it's the potential opportunity. It is to do with electricity infrastructure work that's proposed to happen here. Much of that is still in planning, so we don't know whether it'll proceed or not. And in another guise, the community council carefully looks at all the applications and makes comments according to whether we think it's appropriate and good. But should things proceed, there's where we've just walked over the road, two very large cables will be buried underneath the road. So I wonder if somebody could just make a slightly bigger hole and leave it as an underpass that we could actively move underneath. And if that's not feasible, is it possible to build a bridge instead for pedestrians, horse riders, cyclists, people wheeling things, and get the developers to pay for that so that they're leaving the area better than it was when they arrived?
And that's what they promise, isn't it? And you're hoping that they'll stay true to their word.
Yeah, and the complicating factor, I suppose, is that there are up to 12 developers. They're used to working entirely alone. The planning system pushes them apart and makes them look only at their own proposals. So we're trying to get them to collaborate, which is quite a different way of working. And they all have their own rules about what they can pay for, who they would give the money to, and so on. So all of that stuff you've got to do to get people to collaborate is left with the volunteers in the community council.
And is there a decent strength of feeling for this to happen locally?
Oh, yeah. There's two things to say on that. What's really encouraging, we did a survey because in Scotland at the moment you can write something called a local place plan where you're trying to decide how you'd like the area to be going forward. And because we knew a lot of this development was proposed, we said one of the questions, if you could ask for three things from the developers which they'd leave once they went away, what would you ask for? And the very top asked for thing is a network of active travel paths linking the villages to each other and to the coast. So that was the top vote. amongst all sorts of different people, ages and so on. This would be part of a network. If you're going to build haul roads so that your traffic stays off the minor roads, why not leave them as active paths afterwards? You've got to get people to think differently about what they leave here.
Chris Bruce from East Lammermuir Community Council. I asked Chris how much it might cost to put a pedestrian bridge in, and he thinks it would probably be between £500,000 and £1 million, so it's not an insubstantial amount of money.
No.
But if
and
you
also
had
the idea of riding across it, because he mentioned horses going,
he did.
I thought, not to hope.
Yeah.
Not to hope.
Yeah. It is an interesting idea, though, that if, say, a lot of these projects did get the go-ahead, could they club together and almost leave something like this?
He actually made some very, very good points there. The fact that there are probably about 12 different organisations and they all have, you know, different things that they're trying to do and different standards and different ways they're allowed to do stuff. And it's up to the community council to try and make sense of all that disparity, pull the whole thing together.
Mm-hmm.
Planning, you know, I mean, basically just say, right, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is what we need to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. So rather than do maybe 12 little things that could help the community, do one big one that the folk really want.
Do one big one. And, you know, the underpass, I think, might actually be a bit more of a prospect. But the idea of saying if you're going to have haul roads, you know, leave them there as active travel routes afterwards. Again, I suspect the issue with that is that when they put in the haul roads, they are essentially leasing that land from local landowners to say, right, fine, okay, and then we will reinstate it, but we'll pay this sum of money in advance.
Yeah.
They're going to have to pay a much bigger sum of money to actually say, we want that land off
permanently.
Permanently. And that's going to be it. It does happen quite regularly. Somebody says, you know, you must have been everywhere in Scotland by now. Well, no, we haven't. And here's a perfect case in point. Dean Castle and Country Park in Kilmarnock. Never heard of it. Bruce Morgan of East Ayrshire Heritage and Leisure Team showed me round.
We're standing in front of Dean Castle, the palace and the keep of Dean Castle. The lands of Kilmarnock were awarded to Sir Robert Boyd after his contribution to the Battle of Bannockburn. And an ancestor, a descendant of his, built the first structure here, which we believe is the keep in the mid-14th century.
To me, it looks like a story of two halves. That, the keep, you know, basically a four square, absolutely upright. That's the earliest bit. This has got a feeling of...
It's Renaissance.
Machion was the phrase I was going to use. You know, they're going here for a sort of an effect, you know, an aesthetic.
Yeah. Well, Scottish castles are often classified in terms of their footprint, with a nucleus, which is the keep, which is a very standard, sort of goes back to Norman times, to which other bits are added.
Yeah.
This is a courtyard castle. The keep is there. Then the decision was made to build a completely separate building and then surround it with a barnkin wall.
Okay.
This is associated, we believe, as I say, with Boyd, who was in position in the middle of the 14th century, and this, we believe, was built a century later, at a time when the Boyds were very influential because they had control for a short period of the young James III, and as such had access to resources which previously they hadn't had, and built what we refer to as the palace.
Yeah. It's a handsome building. I mean, it's in blonde sandstone, and it's in pretty good nick, but I understand you had a bit of a kitchen fire in 1735, so that basically destroyed it. And the restoration process really doesn't begin until about the time of the Boer War.
Technically speaking, it's the 1908. There's a clearance process because, although in a sense people talk about the castle being ruined, it was still being used for all sorts of purposes because there was a lot of structure here and it was being used for estate management and agricultural purposes. And it was absolutely full. That courtyard there was absolutely full of all sorts of brick buildings and lean-tos. There was a ducat. There was a kind of residence with a pitched roof, so there was a lot of activity. You just couldn't see it. In the Victorian period, you'll see postcards, and they show an ivy-clad romantic facade. But in fact, what was happening inside was all sorts of work, and all of that had to be cleared away before the restoration really started.
So the 8th Lord Howard de Walden inherits it in 1899, and he starts about a process of restoration, which you say effectively kicks off in 1908. He, however, is what caught my attention with this is he was quite a serious fencer.
Yes.
And I used to fence years ago, and he's therefore got a really interesting collection, you know, of sort of arms and military. Can we see it?
You can indeed. Okay. Well, we have part of it's on display.
Okay.
Part of it's in storage at the Dick Institute.
Okay.
Our museum in the middle of the
Okay. Let's get to the display bit if we can. There we go. Thank you.
We have a school party at the moment, so it's going to be a bit noisy with the kids there.
No, that's okay. That's okay. What we're standing in front of here is a collection case with some of Lord Howard de Walden's sword collection. It's got a Viking sword, Crusader sword, two-handed swords, processional swords, you name it. That's a fantastic range of stuff here.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting in particular, but not very practical, but essentially it's a flick sword. And there's a few inches. It pushes back into a socket, and there's a trigger there, and it jumps out and gives you an extra 6 inches.
You know, that's
sneaky. It's a fascinating thing, but yeah. not practical in any way.
No. And that big two-handed ceremonial sword, yeah. I mean, you would stagger it. You couldn't take that onto a battlefield.
Well, the Lanzknecht, the famous German mercenaries, did use this.
Really?
And it would be, I mean, I think not so much just sheer brawn, but skill. If you actually handled that, you'd find it really is well balanced. The blade is a lot lighter than you think. Mm-hmm. And it would be a matter of technique. But there were a combination of muskets, pikes, etc. But this would have been used by someone who was a bodyguard, let's say, to an important person on the battlefield.
Got it. You know, and you've got some lovely harnesses of armour here too. And one actually mounted on a model horse, not a real horse obviously, but a model horse. And you see something like that, it would completely ruin your day if something like that came towards you.
Indeed, yes, yeah. And it's Maximilian armour, it's the Emperor Maximilian it's associated with, and it's a particular style. In some respects, it reflects the fashionable costume of the time. We'll see the toes, for instance.
Yes.
Prior to that, Gothic armour, for instance, had pointed toes. Uh-huh. It then sort of gradually changes, and you have a very stubby flat toe. You'll see the same thing in paintings of Henry VIII and what have you.
Yeah. Let's head back out, because the kids have found the minstrel gallery. They've got good carrying voices, those kids. I must confess, I'm ashamed to say, I didn't know if this place was here. How big an attraction is this in terms of tourism?
Well, I think we regard it in a sense as a hidden gem to some extent, because there are other venues in Ayrshire, for instance, Killeen, that are very, very well known. But it's certainly since the opening, after the refurbishment, we've had very, very large numbers of visitors. And I've been here with the entire courtyard completely replete with visitors, so I couldn't quote you the actual numbers, but I've certainly been involved in trying to manage the hundreds of people streaming through. The collections are nationally, in fact internationally important, and that's just some of the collection here.
Of all the treasures that's contained within Dean Castle, pick one, and you're not allowed to pick the flick sword. Not that I'd ever heard of such a thing. I would pick that, but...
Well, there's a 14th century bassinet that's very, very simple, but it's...
What is that?
It's a helmet. It's a form of helmet. It's slightly conical, but a lovely, just a beautiful, very simple shape. And it's our earliest helmet.
One of the finest... Oh, there we go. A piece of paper has flooded in. That was Bruce Morgan there, along with some very enthusiastic youngsters at Dean Castle in Kilmarnock. He's saying that one of the best collections I've ever seen of arms and militaria is in Kelvingrove Art Gallery Museum. And I was standing in there one time with a guy called Tobias Capwell III, mm-hmm. who is the curator. A really interesting guy. And we were standing in front of this suit of armour, this complete harness of armour, what have you. And I said, I've got no real sense of this. How good is this? Is this, you know, is this a Mini or is this a Jaguar? And he says, this is a Learjet. He says, this is just the best, full stop, what have you. And I said, see, I wouldn't have. He said, I've got no self-restraint. He says, if I had the keys to these cabinets, I'd be getting in there at night and putting all this stuff on and playing in it, you know. And he hesitated. And I chased it and I said, Why did he? And it turns out that he is an actor. But I'm a historical researcher and an actor, so they take kit and actually rebuild it, etc., and then try and figure out how people actually fought in it.
Oh, nice.
Fascinating. Yeah. Absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I bet it is, actually. I can see you doing fencing. All that sort of strutting about. Yeah.
Sheep fencing, cattle fencing, horse fencing, you name it, you can do any of that. You're listening to Out of Doors on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stevens, she's Rachel Stewart. Coming up, Alloway's giant mural.
And we'll get to the matter of the mystery sound as well. Listen carefully, because it's quite short.
Paul from Hamilton thought it might be a bird diving into water to get a fish.
Yeah, Daryl and Lindsay, is the mystery sound a garden pond motor unit being submerged?
Denise Phil and Reggie says, we lambs at the farm down the road will need extra woolly jumpers this morning. Today's mystery sound, is it the otter we sometimes see in the River Spey slipping almost silently under the water?
Karen says, no. What's the noise Mark dropping the Mark Twain plumb line weight into the canal to measure the depth to check it's okay for the boat's draft? This is very technical, Karen. It's too much for me. Is that called plumbing the depths, Karen?
Yes, it is.
Karen in a less windy South Shetland with no lifeline. I like it. Lots of time to get in touch. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk is the email address, or you can text us 80295 or give Sky a ring on 08085 92950. Now, unless you're a Gaelic speaker, you may find some of the names on your OS map a little difficult to pronounce and understand. Not you, Mark.
No.
You are a scholar.
Absolutely.
That was certainly the case for author Colin Liddell, who decided to research and translate all the Gaelic place names noted on maps within 175 square miles of Bitlochry. For Colin, it was a lockdown project which has given him a much deeper understanding of his local landscape.
Well, it was curious in a way, because we were stuck indoors so much of the time, and I wanted to do something relating to the out of doors. And one of the things that frustrated me all my life was that living in a wonderful area of mountains and hills and lochs, almost all of the names are in Gaelic, and I didn't know what any of them meant. And I thought, how can I live in an area where I just don't know the meaning of anything? So I just started, even as a non-Gaelic speaker, to get hold of dictionaries and go and explore and find out what all those Gaelic names meant in English.
Not just a few Gaelic names, all of the Gaelic names encompassing 175 square miles.
Yes, that's right. And almost all of the place names in that area are in Gaelic, or mostly in Gaelic. A word like Pitlochry has pit in it, which is a Pictish name. And a lot of Gaelic words are conglomerations anyway, but almost all of them are Gaelic.
Why is it not as simple as just being able to approach a Gaelic speaker and asking them to translate it for you?
Well, to an extent, I think one can, but the difficulty is that these names probably originated 100, 200, 300 years ago. They were collected in the sort of 1830s, 1840s by the early officers of the Ordnance Survey. And not all of them were Gaelic speakers. In fact, a number of them weren't even Scottish. And so they were writing down records that are a long aged time. Whereas if you speak to somebody now, they will perhaps have Gaelic from Lewis or from Uist or from Skye. And they've got modern Gaelic. And there are differences. And Perthshire had its own dialect, a lovely dialect of Gaelic, which unfortunately now is pretty much gone. There are people who are relearning it and absolutely impressed that they are. But I think to go back to the old dictionaries, as old as one can get, and Dwelly is the sort of the book, but it's not the only one, where one tries to get an idea of what the meanings could be.
So you started your investigations, and that actually meant visiting all of the locations on foot to see them for yourself. What kind of things were you able to find out?
Well, it's really interesting. Some of them I knew, and I couldn't relate sometimes the possible meaning with the mountain. And then you look at different options. And again, as a non-Gaelic speaker, it's quite tricky because I might think it's X, but actually I didn't know that there was another a Y or a Z, as it were, that could have led me in the right direction. But often by going out to see something, so like a mountain with a name that's got the animal a boar in it, was that where boars were? Or when you go and look at it, you think, oh, actually, that's boar-shaped. And that's why it perhaps had the boar name. So going out to have a look, and the same again, there was one which said it had an overhang. And I thought, really? And I went to have a look at this particular mountain. And sure enough, when you went round the side that you don't normally see from any of the sort of access paths, it has a wee overhang. So by going to have a look at everything, either because you know it or because you're persuaded to try and unravel a puzzle. That's the only way, I think, to really understand what the meaning might have been.
And you've been able to find out that some of the names might actually be wrong.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. I think probably the main one is our local mountain at the back of Pitlochry, Benivraki, which I think for best part of 150 years, and I included in the books of local history that I've written and published, we've all said that it's the Speckled Mountain. But that would not be Vraki, that would be Vraki, the B becoming a BH, which turns it into a V when you speak, because it's in genitive form. And then Dwelly helps us there because there's a word called brak, B-R-A-G, which means a herd of deer. And so I think we're now pretty convinced that Benivraki is the place of the herd of deer, the mountain of the place of the herd of deer. So that's something we're going to have to change, and will I have to write another edition of my book to do that? I don't know.
Was that your most exciting discovery, do you think?
And I don't know. It was an interesting one, and it wasn't my discovery, to be honest. That came up in discussion with others who are also on the place names trail. Most exciting discovery? I don't know. I just loved the fact that I could have a name, and they may not be the correct names, but they've now become my names for all these different places all around the areas that I trample across. And that's what's fun.
And does that enrich the experience for you?
Oh, hugely. And not only from just when you go to somewhere and you go to the shealing of the saddle stone and you know that that's where women who couldn't conceive were put on that stone in the hope that they might have a better chance in the future. You go up Corrie na Cistecian, the Corrie of the coffins, and you think, why is that? And then you realise that the Corrie is shaped like two different coffins, one on top of the other. So I find that really interesting. And just for actual wayfaring, you know, the fact that you're looking for the blue-grey crag or whatever, well, there it is over there, and or the crag of eagles. You can see that that's a lovely promontory that eagles would almost certainly go to. And it just adds interest and direction as you walk around.
You framed the map and you've written a lovely message at the bottom of it. It says, our ancestors speaking their own language named our world from fondness and familiarity. This is my attempt to decipher their world. Do you feel that's what you've done?
For me, yes, and that's why I use the words my attempt, because I'm not a Gaelic speaker and I fear that I tread where I shouldn't. But I have greatly enjoyed doing it. I will continue to do it. I will expand beyond the original 175 square miles. I've already started that. And I know I'll have got it wrong, and I know some Gaelic speakers will tell me I'm a complete clot. But I've had fun, and it's my attempt. And it makes my journeys through these hills that I love just much more meaningful.
That's Colin Liddle and the Gaelic place names of Perthshire. I don't think anyone will be describing him as a complete clot.
No.
You know, you've got a good one on Stranraer.
Aye, Stranraer in Gaelic is Thronraer, which means fat nose.
Of course.
I'm not entirely certain why that is. But it's true. I mean, I've been trying to sort of learn some Gaelic over there was an occasion where there were three occasions in one programme when the Gaelic place names came up and I couldn't pronounce any of them. And it was annoying me. So I thought, right, fine. And I've been doing this Duolingo thing. But there's a cafe on the left-hand side going down south on the, you know, the A90. And it's Balmacuan. Mm-hmm. But if you translate that to Balmacuan, it's the village of the dogs. You know, and I start to spot things that all the way through.
I love these wee stories.
That's good. Coming up, the voles who have turned their back on Waterworld, and the quest to create one of the biggest murals in the UK.
It's actually a really nice morning now. Maybe even nice enough to go camping. Kevin Kerr has been in touch from Malloch. He says they're off to Loch Lomond for our first camping trip of the year today. Are we daft, brave, or maybe both?
Yes.
My wee girl Eve is looking forward to it. Could you please say hello to her? It would make her day.
Morning, hello, Eve. You'll have morning. A lovely time. It'll be great.
You will.
A real
love
adventure.
Every minute. We've also got a mystery sound for you. Listen carefully because this is quite short. That's it.
It is quite short. It is quite short. Ruth in Kirtlaw thinks it might be moles digging under the western peripheral route.
Ah, well, actually, that's interesting because Peter's been in touch. He says, we were just back from a few days in Dunkeld and went across to Creef and Loch Tay one day and we were amazed at the number of molehills everywhere. Is there a reason? Are worms more plentiful this spring? Do you have a mole who can tell us?
I don't rightly know. But the interesting thing is you see them in the corner of fields. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't get a knot. You're going to have to pull that hat.
Sorry.
You're going to have to pull that. Peering myopically from underneath. Chance of tilting her head back so she can actually see what's going on.
It's because I've got a small head and a big hat. Small head because there's nothing in it.
Is that it?
Anyway. Carry on with our mystery sound guesses.
Yeah. Well, no.
There's
a few here that I think are probably quite close to the truth, so I'm not reading
so
them out.
We're not, no. Give you too much of a clue. Get in touch then if you want to have a guess. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text us 80295 or you can call us about anything at all on 0808 592 95 00.
This week has been a historic one for land management in Scotland with the passing of the Wildlife and Muirburn Bill at Holyrood. Now, it does quite a few things, but principally it makes grouse shooting a licensable activity. The legislation has been designed to tackle wildlife crime, in particular the persecution of birds of prey. Kevin Key's been to Amelry in Perthshire, where he spoke to Ross Ewing from Scottish Land and Estates, but first he caught up with Duncan Orr Ewing from RSPB Scotland.
This whole area is divided up into sporting estates, mainly grouse moors. A grouse moor may be 10,000 acres in size. And across that landscape, what we're seeing is a mosaic of patchwork burning. So the heather is burned every 10 to 15 years to create the ideal conditions for red grouse. So you have areas of long heather for grouse nesting and short heather for grouse feeding. And then the other things that are carried out, gamekeepers are employed to carry out predator control. So that mainly involves the killing of foxes and crows to protect grouse. And then the other things that you're seeing here are the use of medicated grit, which is put out. Grouse take in grit, which goes into their gizzard, and the medication prevents some grouse diseases. And also the sheep that you're seeing out here, they are in situ to attract ticks. They're called tick mops, again, to stop tick-borne grouse diseases.
But obviously for years now there's been concern about the amount of birds of prey, raptors, that have been disappearing from landscapes like this. How big a problem has it been historically?
Well, it has been a major problem. Since 1954, all birds of prey in Scotland have been protected. Some birds of prey have started recovering their populations, but sadly, the ones that are most associated with land that is managed for grouse shooting have fared less well. And in fact, some species like the hen harrier have almost been persecuted into extinction in these areas.
And there was a review carried out of satellite-tagged golden eagles back in about 2017. That had some pretty startling results when it was published, didn't it?
Yeah, so that research looked at 130 birds that had been satellite-tagged golden eagles in Scotland during the period of 2004 to 2012, and the research showed that a third of those birds had either been illegally killed or disappeared in suspicious circumstances, mostly on land managed for grouse shooting.
And that was a major step in reaching the outcome that's happened this week, wasn't it? Because that then led on to the Werrety review. How important was that review that was carried out?
Yeah, so on the back of that piece of science, the then Environment Minister, Rosanna Cunningham, commissioned the Werrety Review, which was an independent review of grouse moor management, looking particularly at whether grouse moor licensing or grouse shooting licensing was an option and could act as a deterrent to the illegal killing of birds of prey. It looked at other things as well, such as Muirburn and its impact on peatland vegetation. As we know, you know, peatlands are critically important in terms of addressing climate change. They're vital carbon stores. And we have, as we know, very ambitious net zero targets to meet.
One of the things that came out of that Werribee review was a suggestion that kind of countryside sector should be given 5 years to clean up its act and then consider licensing. But the Scottish Government chose to ignore that advice and go straight for the licensing option through legislation. Was that the right decision?
In our view, yes. We had already had a period of time, not least, period of warnings. I mean, since the Scottish Parliament started in the late 1990s, at that time, the late First Minister Donald Dewar described rapt persecution as a national disgrace and that folk had to clean up their act. That hasn't happened. It's still going on even today. I mean, we've had, you know, incidents of rapt persecution going on even while the Scottish Parliament has been sitting and deliberating over the Wildlife Management Bill.
So how will this legislation now help that situation?
So we think it could be a game changer. You know, the major deterrent here is loss of the right to shoot grouse, which if Police Scotland and Nature Scot are convinced through that rapt persecution is still ongoing, then they have the right to remove that licence. So we move away from a criminal burden of evidence to a civil burden of evidence. And we know that in such landscapes, remote landscapes, it's easier to conceal the evidence of wildlife crime than to find it. So, you know, getting criminal cases against the individuals concerned has been very difficult over the years.
My name is Ross Ewing. I'm the director of Moorland at Scottish Land and Estates.
How significant a week has this been in terms of changes to the practices and how historically moorlands have been managed?
So, yeah, I mean, the legislation is definitely significant. We're going to see some pretty seismic changes in the way that land managers do their business in the uplands. It's really important that we remember that land managers are delivering decisive benefits for biodiversity. And it's important that any legislation that comes out and the regulation that's going to be ultimately looked after by Nature Scot is reasonable and proportionate.
If you're a law-abiding estate worker or a landowner, is it really going to be that much change, that much difference? Because I suppose the motivation behind of all of this is to stamp out illegal activity.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's been long trailed that licences are probably going to be granted as a matter of course. And that's great news. And we welcome a lot of the amendments the government made to the bill to make it more workable and proportionate. But the fact remains is that it still does go well beyond the defined objective of addressing the persecution of raptors. You know, we're talking about a broad range of wildlife crimes for which there's no connection to grouse moor management as potentially being triggers for licence suspension and revocation. And that's disproportionate.
There was a review of satellite-tagged golden eagles back in 2017 that found that most of the ones that had died in suspicious circumstances had been found or disappeared around grouse moors, and that, they said, was suspicious.
So it was actually one-third of the satellite-tagged golden eagles that were looked at over a 10-year period. Look, rapt persecution is abhorrent. It's something that we as an organisation condemn. But successive wildlife crime reports in Scotland, published and commissioned by the Scottish Government, have shown that it's been driven down to the lowest levels on record. That's really significant. Most of the estates are doing absolutely fantastic work for biodiversity, and it's a minority of grouse moors that are participating in illegal activity. And I'm sure the licensing scheme that's been brought to fruition will hopefully sort that out.
Proponents of this licensing scheme say actually Scotland is just playing catch up with many other countries where licensing of this sort of activity happens already. Is that not just fair enough?
No, the licensing regimes that are operating in other countries are very, very distinct from what we're looking at here. And also, it doesn't recognise the fact that the country sport that is driven grouse shooting here in Scotland is unique to Scotland. It's a very unique activity. It brings in a huge amount of tourism and kind of indirect local and regional spending. These are really significant tourism impacts, and I think, you know, it's quite different to the kind of one for the pot type kind of country sport that you would expect to see in other European countries. So I don't think the two things are comparable. It'd be like comparing apples and oranges.
You've described this in the past as using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. How, on a day-to-day basis, will it change how you manage this moorland?
So, I mean, look, licences should be granted as a matter of course. I suppose where we come at is that ultimately it's a disproportionate piece of legislation because it does go further than the policy objective of addressing raptor persecution. Our contention with the government is that good legislation should go no further than it is required to address the policy aim. They've been very clear about what the policy aim is, which is raptor persecution. So why they've seen fit to go beyond that, we have real questions about.
But again, on a day-to-day basis, what will change?
So getting a license should be a relatively straightforward process. That's really, really positive. Where we're going to see potentially some really interesting impacts is in relation to muir burn, the controlled burning of heather. That's a process that we do have significant questions about, because estates are going to have to go and survey their landholding, find out where constitutes peatland and non-peatland. That is going to be a huge amount of work, and we're actually been working with an estate today to kind of figure out how they're going to go about the process of doing that. But I think it is going to be a significant and onerous process for estates, and that is something that, you know, really is not in the interest of people that are delivering decisive benefits for biodiversity.
But ultimately, those peat moorlands are really important for storing carbon dioxide in the ground, which is really important in turn for tackling climate change. Is it not actually critical that we know where those carbon stores are and how big they are?
So, yes, I think it is important that we do know where they are. The difference is that muir burn does not burn peatland. It burns the heather on top of peatland. It does not have an impact on the peatland underneath. So it is bizarre to see the Scottish Government using a below-ground metric to regulate an above-ground activity. It's completely illogical, and ultimately it's going to put a huge burden on estates. But let's be very clear, the latest long-term science in relation to muir burn is showing it does have decisive benefits for peatland. In some cases, land that's been managed with muir burn is actually locking up more carbon compared to land that's been left unmanaged or that's being dealt with by a process called cutting, where you essentially remove it using a flail mower. So it does deliver decisive benefits, and that's really important.
Ross Ewing from Scottish Land and Estates, and quite a few decisive benefits there. And before that, you heard from Duncan Orr Ewing from RSPB Scotland.
Yeah, there's quite a lot to the legislation, isn't there? Because they're also talking about the banning of the use of certain traps as well. Mm-hmm. There's quite a lot in there
different
to get your head around.
And
yeah, that's
that kind
it, exactly. All quite controversial.
Yeah. Anyway.
Hey, we're on to cute things now. This is nice. I like a cute creature.
You do like a cute creature. Waterfalls. Now, as the name suggests, tend to live round water. That's what they do. Except some of them started not doing that. Scott Ferguson is project coordinator at the Seven Locks at Hogginfield in Glasgow, and he told me about it.
Well, the story starts in around 2008, and it starts with pest control officers who were called out to a site in Easterhouse because they thought there was a rat problem. And when they got there and looked into it, discovered that it was actually water voles. And this was right on the edge of the M8 motorway. So completely unexpected to find water voles living in the long grass along the edge of the M8, where the nearest surface water was probably almost a kilometre away. So it was the first time in the UK that it would really recognise this kind of behaviour.
To a certain extent, the clue is in the name, water vole. Why did they turn their back on the water?
We really don't yet know why we've got a population here that's behaving so unusually and in a kind of unique way. There are populations on the islands, in the Scottish islands, that live what's called fossorially, which means they're away from water, they're living in underground tunnels and
they dig,
popping up.
Basically, they dig.
They're like moles. That's what the word really equates to, mole-like. So, yeah, it was very unexpected. And across the UK, the water vole, you know, throughout the latter part of the last century, declined hugely. It was lost from almost 90% of the sites where you would expect to find them. And all of those sites were along watercourses or ponds and ditches. So the water vole in the UK was always really strongly associated with wetland or water habitats. But here, suddenly we were finding them in grasslands away from water. Now, that's something that happens in Europe, with populations in Europe, but it's not been recorded widely in the UK.
The only time I've ever seen a water vole in the wild was actually when I lived in Kirkintilloch. You know, and there was a section of waste ground there, post-industrial. There were some ditches. And I watched one actually sort of coming out of its burrow in the bank, in, you know, getting into the water and swimming along and what have you, and foraging about. They're actually a very attractive animal. You know, they're calling it a water vole, water rat, you know, same difference.
Yeah, we've got some beautiful photographs that people have taken of them, and they are immensely cute to look at. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, the ones that we've got, because they live in burrows, they spend most of their time underground. So to catch a glimpse of them is quite a special moment, really. Now is probably the best time, or into April is the best time to look for
them. Because the grass is
shorter. The grass is shorter, yeah. It's not grown so long yet, and so this is maybe the best time to head out and try and spot water voles. You can spot their signs very easily. You can spot the burrows and the runs through the grass. But yeah, if you actually catch a glimpse of a water vole in one of our grassland sites, yeah, it's a special moment.
What I find fascinating about this is why? Why would they take the decision to actually turn their back on a lifestyle that's been, that they've had for generations of water voles and think, no, actually, I'm going to go away from the water and I'm going to go to the land, I'm going to live beside a motorway and so on. Might it say something about the quality of the water?
I think one of the theories that we have is that before the M8 was built, that was the route of the Monkland Canal. And it may be that when the motorway was constructed and the canal was filled in, there was water vole populations along the canal that had nowhere to go. So what they've done is they've adapted their behaviour to live in these grassland sites. That's a theory. We don't know for sure. What we do know is that it's the same species. So there's no significant difference between the riparian or the water voles to the grassland water voles.
Non-water voles.
We would love to do some genetic studies to really dig into that in a little bit more detail, but that's something that we haven't ever had budget for so far. So because they were only discovered in 2008, really we're still learning about their ecology. And we've done some projects in partnership with Nature Scot and the University of Glasgow to study the population here. And we're starting to understand it better. But yeah, there are still lots and lots of questions that we'd like to answer.
And has the information been fed back to the good people of Easterhouse that they do not have a rat problem? They've actually got a fossorial water vole. It's not even a problem, it's a gift.
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of work with schools in the area, with community groups to try and raise awareness over the unique population here. And one of the things that, you know, we do rely on, we don't have a huge resource for work like this. So we rely on volunteers being able to come and help out, not just with the water vole, but with other nature-based projects in and around the area. So yeah, water voles are just one of the species that, you know, we'd like to know more about in this area.
And just finally, it's probably worth saying, you know, despite the fact that you know they're there and you have this population, that doesn't necessarily mean that the area is hoaching with them. This is still a reasonably rare animal.
Yeah, I mean, it's still one of the most threatened mammals in the UK. And although we have sites here where we've got very good, healthy populations of water vole, there are other sites where they're still vulnerable. So we know we've had sites where they've been recorded over a few years and then we go back and survey them again and they've gone from that site. So, yeah, we've been doing a lot of work, but we need to do more work to really understand what it is they need, what we can do to help provide that. And that's, again, where the work that volunteers can do is a key part of the conservation story of this animal.
Scott Ferguson there from the Seven Locks Project at Hoggenfield in Glasgow. Now, he emphasised several times that volunteers are important in helping to find out more about the water voles, and something called the Mammal Society is hoping to set up a new group in Glasgow to help gather information. Joining us to tell us more is Rose Tony, chair of the local groups committee within the society. Can you just tell us for a start, Rose, what kind of work does the Mammal Society actually do?
Good morning, Mark and Rachel. Hope you're well. Yes, so we are a member-led organisation raising awareness of mammals and the issues that are affecting them. This is actually a really big year for us because we're celebrating 70 years of involving people in gathering data to help us understand exactly what's happening to mammals across the UK.
And it's nice as well that you're actually focusing on urban groups, isn't it, just now?
It is. I mean, the local groups, Mammal Society local groups family is very extensive. It stretches from northwest Scotland down to southwest England. But we don't really have much engagement with urban groups at the moment. And that is the point of a new crowdfunder that we are involved in under the Aviva Community Fund. And it's specifically to help establish urban mammal groups, to help us build up a better picture of what's happening in the urban environment. And one of those new groups will be in Glasgow. So more help for Scott, hopefully.
What do you actually do? I mean, once you've got your volunteers and you've got a group set up, what do you do?
So there are quite a few surveys that are running at the moment. So just to give you an example, of one that's happening in England that has been very, very successful. It's the Harvest Mouse Survey. So we didn't really have a very good picture of what was happening. So Harvest Mouse Survey takes place from about October to around March time. And the Cornwall Mammal Group, for example, a few years ago, we only had a handful of records in that area. And due to the volunteer effort, people going out and searching for harvest mouse nests, we now have several hundred records from the area.
So do you have to give your volunteers a bit of training then so that they know what they're looking for?
Absolutely, yeah. And there's so many benefits to being part of the local group. So as part of that socialisation, it's meeting like-minded people. It's feeling that you're doing something beneficial, but you're also, you know, really helping build up a picture. And to do that, we do provide training. And this fundraiser will help us do that for urban groups. So it can help us provide equipment that we can loan to local groups. It can help us with things like insurance for the local groups. It can help with documentation. So it's providing that support that's really essential.
What kind of person joins the Mammal Society to become a volunteer? Does it tend to be sort of retirees and quite young people?
Well, historically, Mark, yes, we do have a very solid base. But we are actually really working hard to increase the diversity of people involved. And you mentioned young people, for example, and they are a real target audience for us. So young people, as you'll know, conservation is one of the least diverse sectors. So we're trying really hard through our mammal groups, where there's a bigger concentration of younger people, to provide that training to help them connect with more established groups and to get them involved, because young people, they're just so energised and that they just need a little foot, a foothold on the career ladder. So yeah, getting young people involved is a really key audience for us.
We've heard about water voles, obviously, but are there any other creatures that you have your eye on that you want to find a bit more out about?
Yeah, all the time. We're constantly sort of doing horizon scanning to see what surveys that we can be developing with our local members. We have another survey running at the moment as well. And as we know, some others use the urban environment. We also have one that's very much a Scottish survey. So that's mountain hare survey. So Scotland obviously is a stronghold for these gorgeous creatures. So we talked, Scott talked about how cute water voles were, but what is lovelier than a mountain heron's lovely winter coat? So there's just a whole range of things. And come back to the urban environment, people may not think about the diversity of species that use the urban environment, but we have bats, we have otters, we've got hedgehogs, small mammals, and even in Aberdeen we have dolphins right in the harbour mouth. So, you know, constantly getting people involved and reporting what they're seeing, or indeed what they're not seeing, is really important.
And if people are interested in coming forward and volunteering and taking part in these surveys and things, how do they go about it?
If they want to just get some basic information, a good place to start is the Mammal Society's website. They can get in touch with me if they're interested in finding out how to set up a local group themselves. My email address is localmammalgroups@themammalsociety.org. And of course, they can go to the Aviva Community Fund and type in urban mammals, and they can donate a pound or two to help other groups get set up. Any queries at all, just come to me.
Rose, thank you very much for joining us this morning. That was kind of you.
You're very welcome.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, we had a little vole out the back of our old house, and it was quite near a barn, and we've got very, very cute pictures of it. And my daughter, who was quite young at the time, was absolutely fascinated by it. But we could never really tell if it was a water vole or a field vole or a bank vole. Uh-huh. And I'm still not sure. I don't think I'd be a very good volunteer with the Mammal Society.
We were in St Kilda a few years ago, and there's a thing called the St Kilda Mouse, and we thought, oh, you know, but great if we could just cast a fleeting glimpse of this elusive creature, what have you. And there was one walk past our cottage, and I had a video camera with me at the time, and I was in a ditch as this thing walked past, and I was so close to it, I had to back off because it was within the focal length of the camera. Mm-hmm. You know, it just could not care less. Could not care less. Sonsy wee thing it was. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. Sitting right next to me here at Beech Grove is Rachel Stewart. If you miss any of this, there is no excuse, because there are a few ways of listening.
You know the drill. You can catch up whenever you like by looking the programme up on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, also available from BBC Sounds. Internationally recognised and enjoyed around the world. We love hearing from you. Get in touch and let us know where you listen.
And it's time for our mystery sound again. Have a listen. And that's it.
Hardly worth the effort, really.
Dot in Edinburgh says, is it a dipper bird in the river? Good guess, actually.
It is a good guess.
Graham in Rosemount, a quiet day before a trip to an Aberdeen Jazz Festival concert featuring Tommy Smith, terrific Scottish sax player. Superb. Is the mystery sound a trout rising?
No, right, fine. Nice one. Let me see. Stuart Elgin says, morning, Mark and Rachel. My guess for the mystery sound, is it a rowing oar coming out of the water? And Julian Letham says, is the mystery sound a marine mammal submerging?
All good guesses.
You need to be slightly more specific than that.
Yeah, we're being quite hard on you today.
Yep. Kyle says, used to look forward to my weekend starting with the latest edition of your programme. However, since getting Beth, an adorable and energetic 14-week puppy, my weekends start an hour or so earlier to give me something to listen to as I pace the garden in my pyjamas. It's a strange place to have a garden. I wondered whether you'd be able to give me a change of start time as well. No! No is the answer to that.
Well, I'd be quite happy for an 8 o'clock start. That sounds very nice.
Get out of it.
Get in touch if you want to have a guess then for our mystery sound. outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295 or you can give us a ring on 0808 529500.
Doogie and Anya and Cooper, this is an interesting idea, saying, are we seeing more mole activity because of the water tables everywhere being higher due to the wet months we've had, forcing moles into different higher ground?
Oh, that's quite interesting, isn't it? Kevin, who we spoke about a little earlier, who's going on a camping trip to Loch Lomond, says, thanks so much for the mention. Eve is over the moon. Oh, we like to oblige.
Neil Walker says, please say hello to myself and Paul McMahon. We completed the last stretch of the Camino de Santiago from Vigo to Santiago yesterday. Today we're having a more leisurely walk around Santiago to take in the wonderful history of the city. I would love to do that.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, the Camino Real.
Really good.
Yeah. The whole idea of pilgrimage, just fascinating. Other comments come in. Ian says, all of my diary entries in the last 15 years when I bothered to note blackbirds starting to sing their springtime songs in my garden, 2010, 2011, 2019, and this year have been in the last week of March. Well, interestingly, because our blackbirds kicked off, Ian, I would say, the end of February.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been quite vocal since then.
Yeah. Craig Wilson in Cardonald says, talking earlier about Gaelic names, our first dog was called Isla, a beautiful labradoodle. When she passed, I thought it would be nice to name our next dog with a connection to Isla. So I bought an OS map of Isla, thinking I would easily find a decent name from the various place names.
Easy.
All Gaelic and unpronounceable to me. The only one that I could come up with was Port Charlotte. So we named our new labradoodle Lottie. So our old Isla lives on in Lottie. That's a lovely one.
And one last comment. Andrew near Mary Kirk says, I have an 1822 map of Concardenshire, and I referenced Balmacuin as possibly Balnacuin, the village of the dogs, but he says in 1822 it's spelled Balnaqueen.
You could go back a bit.
It's all over the shop. Nobody knows. Increasingly, artists and musicians, like everybody else in society, are thinking more about climate change, environmental issues, and we've got a good example to share with you now.
Yeah, Laura Beth Salter and Ali Hutton are both professional musicians working in the folk and trad scene. It was a shared concern over climate change that prompted them to collaborate on a new album, which they say is an ode to nature.
Helen Eden went to meet them in Glasgow Green to hear more about it.
So the album is From the Ground. We're called From the Ground, and the title song is called From the Ground. For this project, we just want to be really honest. We're not trying to fit it into a category or whatever. So I was like, what is From the Ground? Like, how can I lyricise what it is that we're doing? So I decided to write... It's going to sound so cheesy now that I say it, probably, but I decided it would be cool to write it from the perspective of a tree.
That's not cheesy at all. That's a brilliant thing, and other people have done that. The best nature writing ever is. It's changing perspective.
Yeah, you put yourself in the perspective, and it particularly was relevant for me to do that at that point because the other songs I've been working on, which I haven't released yet, are for another album, which is all about space. So I was thinking, like, if we're talking about what's happening with our climate, and you know. We're seeing so much destruction on the earth. What happens if you're something that can't move? If you're completely rooted, you can't just leave when somewhere gets beyond livable with pollution or with climate change or whatever. So the From the Ground song is from that perspective of that tree that's stood for probably hundreds of years and can't move. So it doesn't have an option. It can see the encroaching situation, but it can't move, it doesn't have the option. That's where that song comes from.
The sky is aglow.
have a particular tree in mind when you wrote that song?
No, I didn't. It was a total imaginary tree in my head.
Do you know what kind of tree it would be? When you were thinking about it
probably,
in your mind's eye?
To be honest, I was spending quite a lot of time. I wrote that song, I think I must have written, did I write that during the pandemic? Or just
so, yeah.
I think I did, yeah. And Callum and I spent loads of time walking in the Arboretum in the west end of Glasgow, and there's these huge oak trees in there. So
I was thinking it could be
an
oak.
And also the redwoods. There's these massive redwoods outside of Cumgrove Art Gallery. So it would have probably been inspired a bit by those, looking at those. I spent loads of time around those trees, learning the trees, because I've never done that ever in my life. Never kind of gone...
Paid attention?
Yeah, never paid attention. Just walked by and gone, oh, that looks nice, but... There's still time to turn this around.
We can keep going from the ground.
There's people who don't have the option to leave the place they're in, so it represents them too. There is hope in it, because in the song's saying there's still time to change this. The hope element's important for us, but mainly my idea was that these things grow from the ground. They're incredibly important. It's what, you know, we breathe because of them. A silent sky so still, there's no bird song to be heard here. They saw the warning. Will you heed it? Your fire is growing higher. Something else we had in common that we enjoyed following was this guy on Twitter called Nick Ray. His name
Oh, yes, I know Nick. Yeah,
and his kayak. And he and both of us, it's funny because we had both seen him independently, but Ali had like spotted his name and was thinking about contacting him about this project. And I was like, oh, is that the guy in the kayak? Oh, I think he's so inspiring. The connection that he has with nature and his mental health, and he's quite kind of open about that. It's such a great thing to do, because I think it can make other people consider that for themselves, and maybe they might get some benefit from that. And then we started thinking about that for the album, didn't we?
The feeling when I was following him on social media, it was the kind of feeling that the end section of that piece was giving me. So I wanted to name that tune after him, called it Life Afloat, which is his blog name. And then I got in touch with him and asked him if he minded if I called that tune after that, and perhaps if he was okay and he felt like it, would he record some words and some feelings about his experience and stuff. So he's on the album at the very end of that track, just chatting about how nature makes him feel.
When I'm out at sea in my kayak, I feel deeply at peace. Even if the sea is rough and tempestuous, I feel quiet and content within myself. The sea is my place. That's where I belong. For a while, you can just be.
The voice of Nick Ray there on the album From the Ground, which has been made by musicians Laura Beth Salter and Ali Hutton. If you'd like to hear more about that, have a listen to the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, available now on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, I listened to it this week. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Really nice music in there. Nice to hear Nick's voice again as well. I think he inspired a lot of people.
It is, yeah. We must actually catch up with him to find out what he's up to at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he's very artistic as well. I think he was involved in art projects,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, the last time I met him, I met he and his wife up on Sky, and we're just sitting having a bit of a chat there. But we're trying to find a quiet place round about the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So, just literally down in the water, there was one of these little huts, and with like a hot tub.
Yeah,
but this was 10:30 in the morning. I mean, what right thinking person's going to be in a hot tub at 10:30 in the morning? It's a ludicrous suggestion. And we're sitting there because there's nobody about, there's nobody in the hut, whatever. We thought it was quite quiet, and we were away from the traffic, and we're sitting there. And all of a sudden, all these young people started turning up with like some trainers on and swimsuits and things. And they're going, oh, this is getting a bit embarrassing. We better go. Said, we want to go in the hot tub. You just crack on. We're going to go somewhere else.
I think I've been in on hen parties where we've been in hot tubs at 10:30 in the morning.
I, hand on heart, I have never been in a hot tub in my puff.
Have you not?
No.
All right. Well, no. Maybe find a piece where you can spend some quality time in a hot tub.
I did, however, go out this week with the Baltic Boys
in
Aberdeen Beach, which you can hear in probably next week. And it certainly wasn't hot.
No, I bet it wasn't. But you've survived the experience. So
they were
great.
A really nice bunch of lads. I had a thoroughly nice time, actually. Really
now, you
it.
May remember last year I visited the Alloway Railway Tunnel to hear about plans to create a giant mural within the structure. The artist tasked with the transformation is Chris Rutterford, and he is the man behind the popular Collinton Tunnel mural near Edinburgh, just the south of Edinburgh. Have you visited
yeah,
it?
I've been,
yeah,
it's excellent.
Really,
yeah,
really good.
Very good.
So for several months now, Chris, and it's no exaggeration to say hundreds of people from the community have been working on creating giant paintings on boards. And the whole idea of this is to reflect the local culture and heritage of Ayrshire. Last week, he was back in the tunnel starting to hang these terrific paintings.
Well, I'm absolutely delighted because I've had murals in every part of my studio and boards, and I've been teasing bits of it on social media, but now's the moment where it actually hits the wall and we're putting it up.
It's such a transformation. You know, the last time I was here, very little had been done. Talk me through then what we've got here so far.
Well, I mean, I first actually came in this tunnel over 10 years ago when I did a Tam O'Shanter mural, and it was hung in the Robert Burns Birthplace Museum. And the director took me down here and he said, is there anything you can do about this tunnel? And I was like, well, no, because it was beyond me at the time. But having done the Collinton Tunnel, at the moment, the guys here from the Alloway Railway Tunnel charity got in contact. I was like, I know exactly the tunnel you mean. And yes, I know what to do now. So it's just really chuffed that it's coming full circle and I'm actually going to get to sort this hole in the ground out.
One of the first things you see, of course, is Robert Burns himself. That was important given the location of this tunnel, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that without Robert having been here, we wouldn't be here either. That's why this is a significant hole. And the fact that we've got Mungo as well, with Mungo's mither hanged herself at the other end and the Brigadoon, is just amazing. So I'd always wanted to have Tam O'Shanter on his horse at the end, bearing down on the Brigadoon. But I think it was just really important that we put Rabbi in first. And I'm going to say almost got him out of our system so we can get on with the rest of the Ayrshire history as well.
So what else have you got here? I have to say it's incredibly colourful.
Well, in my Rabbi portrait, I went up to the museum and had a good look about. And they've got a desk that kind of, it just looks lonely. I mean, the fact that he wrote these poems there, but there's none of his brain and none of his clutter on it, I just thought, God, if you took my studio and took all my stuff out of it and said this is his studio, it would be like, well, it just looks like any room, you know? So I've kind of got the desk and then he's got like his snuff cup, his snuff horn and the cup he drank his hot toddies and a lot of 18th century bump around, as well as him writing on his poems and just references to a lot of the other poems that he wrote. You know, we've got nods at My Love Is Like a Red, Red Rose and Te Amus and all of that in there. I just think he's got to look alive. You know, just because he's dead, that's no excuse. I just think, well, I want to have soul in my painting and that's what I bring to things. I bring soul to this tunnel, but I'll also bring soul to him.
Lots of colourful animals as well. I see a pink pig here and a giant chicken.
Well, the chicken is a cockerel that my wife, Luby, just absolutely loved this cockerel. It's actually called Minstrel that used to, when she was on the Isle of Lewis, it used to come along and hang around with her and our dog, Rona. But the pig, we did workshops in the Burns Cottage in September last year. And it was so nice to actually be in the place that Burns was born and grew up. And then we had 800-odd members of the community from Doonfoot Primary and Alloway Primary and about 200-odd members of the public who came in, and they actually helped paint the mural, but they also painted small animals and creatures. And so the scene will be populated by their artwork as well as my professional artwork. Because I'm a professional artist, I'm supposed to be a grown-up, but they can have a laugh. You know, so the mural will have weight, but it will also be funny and joyful.
To ask almost a technical question as well, what's it like to hang the work on this kind of surface? Is that quite challenging?
Tunnels are like grottos. They're holes in the ground and the water comes from the roof. The water seeps through the walls. They also sweat and you get condensation. So we had to try and work out ways to protect it from the green algae that was in it. So we had to clean it all up, and then we put a drip tray that kind of deflects a lot of the water from the top, but then we've got an air gap down the back, and the water will drip down the back. So it becomes a sort of minor civil engineering job, building job, really, to try and protect it.
A group from Alloway Primary School have just come into the tunnel, and this is the first time that you've probably had a chance to have a good look at the mural. What do you think of it so far?
I think it's absolutely amazing. So I did the horse chestnut tree, and I think I did some of the oak.
Well, basically, I did the same thing as Hattie did. I was doing the trees and all sorts, and I think it's very pretty.
What was it like doing something this big?
Crazy.
Yeah. And did you have any idea what it would look like, you know, when it was on the wall here?
No, I'm actually very shocked. Like, I didn't realise it was going to look like this.
What is it that stands out about it, do you think?
Just all the bright colours and how they all blend together.
I see animals, I see, like, all these trees growing and leaves. I think it's very pretty. Nice.
I see, like, leaves and ants and animals. I think it's beautiful, like, the trees standing out. You can see everything, and it's all clear.
Oh, thanks to the B5 class at Alloway Primary and to artist Chris Rutherford there. And about a quarter of the tunnel's been transformed so far. It's an ambitious target. They're hoping to do the whole thing within a year, and this will create one of the biggest murals in Scotland. It's impressive stuff. And we didn't quite have time to hear from Stuart, who's one of the trustees of this, but he's spent a lot of time up a cherry picker cleaning out that tunnel. Yeah. And he's been enjoying, over just the last few days really, just watching people come into the tunnel and go, wow, what a transformation, because it is. It's incredible what they've done in actually quite a short space of time.
These are really good spaces. Really good spaces. But, you know, hanging something in a space like that must be an absolute nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Mm. It's a challenge on so many levels.
It's all good fun until it falls off and scones a cyclist. You know, dang,
you know. Oh, so I still can't quite get my head around how it's all going to be kept dry, but they assure me it will. It'll be fine.
Yeah, it'll be grand. Yeah. It'll be grand. If you haven't heard it, go on to BBC Sounds and have a listen to a podcast series called The Banksy Story.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, about the graffiti artist Banksy. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating, absolutely yeah. fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned a lot about that. So, today, down in Lanarkshire, there's a point-to-point meeting. Now, that might mean absolutely nothing to you. Certainly, that was the case when we spoke about it in the production meeting. Yes, they do exist. They went, a what? So, but let's go down and talk to them, right? Okay, so I met up with trainer Willie Young at Overton Farm, where the point-to-point race is held today, and Archie Gilbert, who's in charge of building the course and the jumps, and started off by saying, okay, Willie, what is it?
Point to pointing is amateur steeplechasing. Horses racing over 3 miles or 2 mile 4 over steeplechase fences, 4 foot 1 to 4 foot 3. It originated 200 or 300 years ago when they were racing across the country from one steeple to another steeple in a different county.
It was kind of an offshoot of fox hunting as well. There was an association there. When it wasn't the season, they would do this instead.
Yes, that's exactly right. But modern times, it's moved on now. There's less and less rural people got horses now. It's more and more people look with a horse wanting fun and getting somebody else to train the horse for them.
You mentioned the steeplechase fence. We're standing in front of it. Archie Gilbert, the course builder, is basically... He's not towering over it, I think it's fair to say. His flat cap is just over the top of that fence and no more. Talk me about the construction of these things. How are they put together?
Well, it's a metal frame. It's birch that goes into the fences. You've got a 6-inch variation that you can have for your height. The birch is packed into the fences. No nearly as tight now as it used to be. Mm-hmm. Fences used to be much, much solider. But
almost like a wall.
Correct. But for the sake of horses no tipping up and everything being a bit safer, we're making the fences a lot softer. They've still got to be jumped because they are big fences and the boys are coming at them at a full gallop, but a horse making them right just makes it look easy, you know, and makes it look an absolute treat.
At a full gallop, where are they taking off and where are they landing at this jump?
They would be taking off ideally probably 4, 5, 6 feet from the takeoff board.
Okay.
And they would be landing the same on the other side.
Okay.
That if they get it right.
If they get it right.
If they get it right.
And if they don't get it right?
If they don't get it right, if they take off too quick, they can land into the jump. If they're in too tight, they can catch it. And that's when you would get more horses tipping, you know, if they catch it high up. But we're lucky here because the course is a flat course. And the 20 years we've been here, this course has never been better than it is this year. Yeah. It's perfect going. If we were running the day, it would be running. Where did you put the going on this morning, Wassels? Good to soft?
The going, I would say, today is good to soft. It's got a good cover of grass on it. I think, if you want, most of the courses have had a lot of rain, but I think, to be quite honest with you, this year, the west of Scotland's had less rain than the east of England, you know? Uh-huh. So if you look at the crops, that's an indication that we don't have the same puddled areas in our winter crops.
You are a farmer. What are you doing running races?
Well, horses are... I think you keep horses yourself, do you?
Yeah.
And they get into your blood.
Misery loves company.
So, horses are a disease. And
tell me about it.
And you kind of recover from it. The Lanark and Renfrewshire Hunt, we're looking for a venue. And my dad and the late Alec Ferguson, who was the groundsman at Hamilton Park, actually, at the time, he and my dad decided that Overton was a good place to have a point-to-point, good flat course, 1.25 miles round.
Is this a former river? I mean, it must have been River Valley, because to be as well-drained as it is.
Actually, Mark, it is, and there's a wee bit of a story here. The big house across the river there is Milton Lockhart House. Don't ask me when it was built, but originally the river came diagonally across here to the bridge, and they dug it out by hand and had it coming straight towards the big house.
Oh, now, for the view.
For the view.
You say, I mean, this is amateur steeplechasing, etc., and they are going lickety-split round here for price money of £150, which will be more or less cover the diesel for getting here in the first place. Is this a stepping stone for people who want to be professional jockeys?
For the horses, it's two things. It can either be young horses going up the way towards professional ranks, and that's where people do make their money. You know, they sell on young horses that have showed a bit on the point-to-point course, or for the other horses that are not just quite good enough and have passed their time, or, you know, are just finding life very difficult. Mm-hmm. They come back to point-to-point and they find it a bit easier, and therefore it gives young jockeys good experience. It's a weight issue as well, because some of them are, you know, they carry a bit more weight on point-to-point and the jockeys, and therefore they're able to do it here.
How big a field would set off in one of these races?
Well, the fields, we're hoping this week we've had a good entry. Probably an ideal race for the sake of punters and everything else would be about 10. Okay. But we could have... Are we allowed to run to 16?
Safety factor 16.
16. If you get more than 16, you have to split the race. But
so I'm trying to imagine 16 horses crossing this jump at once.
That's
pandemonium
right.
Is the word that springs to mind.
That's right. Well,
at speed.
That would happen because the start is down by the side of the Clyde here.
Aye.
So they're on a hurry to the first fence.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a big field, by the time they get to here, which was the third fence, they would be strung out a wee bit.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they're getting to here the second time round, they could be strung out a long road.
Yes.
Did you used to compete in that?
Have you had a look at me? When I was 16-year-old, I was 16 stone, so that didn't help. I do ride, and I still ride, with the boys Fortunately, the boys, my son and my nephew, are quite keen on the horses now, so they ride more, and it makes it life a lot easier for me. Like, you know.
Imagine how a horse feels when he jumps off and a lad of 10 stone jumps on.
As if it had wings.
That's right.
As if it could fly.
Unfortunately, some of mine don't have very fast flapping wings.
But racing's always called the sport of kings. I've been to this event before, you know, when it was actually running, and what I really liked about it was, I mean, it was a family event.
That's right.
Everybody from the area actually comes along to this kind of thing, and it belongs to the community.
Absolutely, that's one of the things that there is a bit of a buzz in the valley just because of point to point. As soon as you start putting fences on the fields, you know, and a bit of white rail up, and then everybody gets excited about it. And the good thing about the point is you're right on the edge of it. You know, you're right there. You're not sitting away up in a grandstand. You're right at the side. Like, you step out from here to there, you're 15 yards maximum away from this jump here, and The people love the buzz of it. Bookies quite like coming as well, you know, because they're it's an uneducated crowd, so therefore the bookies get a wee turn as well, you know, and people, you know, the people enjoy a wee punt, like, you know.
That's a nice phrase, actually, because I am an uneducated punter. And the last time I came here, I very much took Archie's advice and I lost a fortune.
Archie Gilbert and Willie Young there, a.k.a. Wurzel, of the Overton point-to-point races near Carluke. If you'd like to go along, the racing starts at noon today, and if you can't make it today, there's a further race day on the 27th of April, and you'll find further details on our website.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Time to reveal our mystery sound now. Let's have our final listen of the morning. Take long, does it?
It really doesn't take long, no.
Quite a lot of right answers. Have you got incorrect ones first?
No,
they're all correct.
All correct.
And the answer is da 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 da.
John McKenzie in Otley says, it's the plop of a water vole disappearing into a burn, usually the only thing you see or hear of them.
Yep. Jonathan in Windy Oban getting it right. Roe Scott in the Black Isle also identifying the plop of a water vole diving in.
Geography girl on the Tor Finn says, I dozed off. Really? And missed the crucial with a sit-rep situation report. I know what sit-rep means. From Peace Grove Gardens this morning. So unsure if the wind has Arctic characteristics like yesterday. It's not warm.
No, it's not particularly warm. It's not as bad as yesterday, though. Yeah. Yesterday was freezing.
Yeah, Geography Girl says, a quick what's the weather like would be appreciated before I venture out of doors if possible. Carl, is the mystery sound a water vole slipping into water, or was the clue a red herring? Red herring makes a completely different noise.
Ron from Stirling, is it a vole jumping into water after hearing a plane on the flight path to Aberdeen Airport?
Scott and Nadia from Bothwell saying, that's the sound of me unblocking the toilet yesterday. No, it's not. Don't do that. Though my wife thinks the sound of a water vole gently slipping into the water.
Oh, Mike in Turra says, morning, a wet, cool and windy dug walk here in Turra. Is the sound of a water vole leaving its burrow and dropping into the water? All correct. Very good.
Yeah. No, I said the only place I've ever seen was on Cacantilla. You know, and I actually got a really good view of it, you know. So dropped into the water, slipped through the water, came out the other side, climbed onto the bank and thing, in a fossorial manner.
Oh, very good, just throwing that in. I think I've seen one as well now.
Oh, well, there you go. We checked it out. Fossa is Latin for ditch or trench. That's all we've got time for. Don't forget the New Scotland Outdoor podcast, available today at noon, and our midweek podcast on Wednesday, which features the Coolins in Skye. From all the team, thanks for listening.